The report of my death. This reminds me. 9 years ago, when we were living in Tedworth Square, London, a report was cabled to the American journals that I was dying. I was not the one. It was another Clemens, a cousin of mine, who was due to die but presently escaped by some chicanery or other characteristic of the tribe of Clemenses. The London representatives of the American papers began to flock in with American cables in their hands to inquire into my condition. There was nothing the matter with me, and each in his turn was astonished, and not gratified, to find me reading and smoking in my study and worth next to nothing as a text for transatlantic news. One of these men was a gentle and kindly and grave and sympathetic Irishman, who hid his disappointment the best he could and tried to look glad and told me that his paper, The Evening Sun, had cabled him that it was reported in New York that I was dead. What should he cable in reply? I said, say the report is exaggerated. He never smiled, but went solemnly away and sent the cable in those exact words. The remark hit the world pleasantly, and to this day it keeps turning up now and then in the newspapers when people have occasion to discount exaggeration. The next man was also an Irishman. He had his New York cablegram in his hand from the New York World. And he was so evidently trying to get around that cable with invented softnesses and palliations that my curiosity was aroused, and I wanted to see what the cable did really say. So, when occasion offered, I slipped it out of his hand. It said, if Mark Twain dying, send 500 words. If dead, send 1,000.
What has mythology told you about death? What do you think about death?
Well, the way, if one can identify with the consciousness of which the body is a vehicle and really achieve an identification with the consciousness of which the body is a vehicle, not knowing what it is, undifferentiated consciousness, one can let the body go. I like what I heard of Woody Allen, you know, I'm not afraid to die, I just don't want to be there when it happens. You can have disengaged yourself from the body and not be there, you might say.
And yet, you know from myth and nature that the body dies. It perishes, it rots. We're back to the beginning of the
mother. So you expect it. Growing old. I mean, you know what's happening. The body is rotting. It's dying. It's losing its energy. There's more mass than energy here. And the identification then with the life which in a plant survives pruning, cutting, and even eating, the plant is right back there again, is you might say, a biological image that is metaphorical of this spiritual mystery.
There's a wonderful report of the Indians riding into the rain of bullets from Custer's men, and they're saying, it's a good day to die.
It's a great day to die. They're not hanging on. That's the message of the myth. You, as you know yourself, are not the final term of your being. And you must die to that one way or another. Giving of yourself to something, or in being annihilated, actually, physically, to return, you might say, or to recognize. Life is always on the edge of death, always. And one should lack fear and have the courage of life. That's the principal initiation of all of the heroic stories.
So in order to tell you the facets of this journey with death, it is necessary to tell stories. Stories that are old but young. Stories that are of our time but also outside of our time. For in stories, as in no other way, the ancient and the new, the past, present, and future are all in conjunctio, meaning in harmonious relationship to one another. So the one thing I ask from you now is this. Listen to these stories with your soul hearing, with the ears that belong to your soul. is how it is not. It is not that we have a meeting with death somewhere off in the future, but rather we are on a pilgrimage here on this planet, and death is our great compañera, our great companion. It was she who cradled and protected us as we were being born from our mother's thighs. She steps every step we step, sings every song we sing, and weeps when we weep. And it is she, death, the best friend, who will midwife us again in the second birth at the end of this life, the birth into the next world. By the side of the road. His skin was so shiny that his bones showed through. His feet were so worn, their soles were like two brown oak leaves, wrinkled. And his bony skull was laced with veins that pulsed with his heartbeat. And all he wore was a little rag around his waist, a tiny little rag that was part loincloth and part sash. But it was not always this way. When he'd been newborn, a tall, thin tinker had appeared in the village, and somehow his poor parents had purchased a long and beautiful coat from the traveling merchant. And as the tinker had promised, the coat was not only long and beautiful, it also had a certain magic about it. And as the boy grew, also did the coat grow longer and longer, keeping stride with its boy. At last he attained manhood, and he was a handsome man in his beautiful coat. And more than that, when he needed rest, the coat covered him from head to toe. And when he needed food, he reached into the pockets of the coat, and food was provided him. And when he was lonely, he curled up in his coat and he felt wanted. But as in all things, he traveled and he aged, and the beautiful coat began to wear away. First it became thinner around the cuffs, and the hem was not so strong anymore as it had once been. And then he tore it on a wooden nail. And though wherever he journeyed, he washed the coat in rivers and pounded it with a stone to make it clean again, some tiny holes were left in the torso of the fabric. And later there was a long rip up the back from a snarling dog, and several short tears on the shoulder from where he'd been set upon once by thugs. And finally, from sitting and standing and laying and walking so much, the bottom of the coat wore so thin you could hold it up and tell the time of day through it. So with his knife, the man cut away the bottom of the coat and he made a halfway handsome jacket. Except for fraying around the cuffs and collar, old tear stains, many food stains, it stayed as it was for a long time. The man wore it on all of his travels. It kept him warm, and he felt wanted. When he was hungry, he reached into the pockets, and it fed him. But in time, it too began to wear again. And as he himself became aged, his jacket became more and more ragged. And he tore a sleeve on something he could not recall what. And then he tore the other sleeve on something he could not remember what it was. And pretty soon, the sleeves were in ribbons. and so it seemed good fortune that the man met a tall, thin tinker at the crossroads. "Why, my man, your jacket is in tatters. Here, purchase one of mine." And the tinker showed the man his wares. "Oh, how much I should desire to purchase this one." The man gently touched with his grimy finger a pure, white, long coat with a rose-colored collar and gold trim about the cuffs. But alas, the man had no ability to pay. So as was meant in these matters, the tinker and he parted ways, and the man traveled onward by himself. In the morning, as he awakened, the sleeves of his jacket fell away from the seams like leaves from a tree, and without any extra work, the man was left with a vest to wear. And this he did, and proudly. And he was of good humor, for it served, although not as well as before. It served nevertheless. And when he slept, it covered him more or less. And when he was lonely, he pulled it tighter and felt cared for. In the pockets was still nourishment. And so it went, and of course the vest wore more and more until finally it was hanging from his shoulders in rags. And he said to himself, "Well, I shall use it still, and I shall fashion it into a sash." And that is what he did. And there was still a little pocket there over on the side. And when he searched into it, there was still a little food. And when he slept, he was covered in the middle, but bare to the sky at both ends. And in truth, he did not always sleep well, for he was not as warm as he used to be. And now when he felt lonely, there was not much to pull toward himself, but there was enough, and he was of good spirit. Then, on his last night, he was sleeping in his raggedy jot of sash, as though having a life of its own, began to unravel. First, one thread broke and curled upward, and then another, the threads making no sound, but breaking and opening the way a rose opens in the spring. And the old man, with every breath he took, broke more of the threads and more, until suddenly through the opening of the frail sash out leapt the old man's luminous soul, which raced up and out to the mid-heavens in a boundless joy, looking back to the earth fondly, but not with regret. And although souls are almost never surprised, this soul, whose old man body now lay still at the roadside, this soul, who was he, was indeed surprised and joyous to behold himself wrapped in a soft white coat with a rose-colored collar and fine gold trim about the cuffs, and even more so how it billowed about the soul, being a sail taking him onward as always. So, first let us understand that death is not something we embark on when we are old or sick, but rather death is like an old nurse who comes into this world with us on the day we are born, and it is our relative, our companion, our nurturer, our doctor, our healer, and finally, our midwife, our transporter into the next world. We prepare all of our lives for death, even if we die very young. We have been close to death since before the day we were born. Death is in the womb with us, not as some think as a threat, but as a protector. There are many, many symbols for death, like the tinker who appears at the crossroads. Death is always present with us, for it is the archetype of life. And the two, death and life, cannot be split from each other without having just a half of something. There are those who say that if you just snap your head to look real fast, you can always see death standing about or dancing or making jokes or playing chess just right out of the corner of your eye. In the story of the radiant coat, the skin of the coat represents the spirit invested in the body. Its energy. It gives, sustains, heals, and dies, just as it is meant. And the coat is given by Death himself, the old tinker. But not at the end of life, but at the beginning of life. And more so, when one coat is worn through and through, another is given. And this is our testament with Death. This is the promise. The promise is continuation. In fairy tales and myths, time out of mind, over and over again, the theme of death as renewer, as continuer, as creator occurs again and again, even in the most primitive peoples. These concepts survive in the dream life of all people as well as in the arts of Aborigines. The concept of death as giver of life spark, as well as old nurse to cradle the dying. The old man in the radiant coat does not seek to escape his fate, but rather to harmonize with it, and to make a little, a jot, a tittle, enough. And so there can be nothing greater with regard to death than preparing consciously for that last turn through the knot that comes at the end of life here on this planet. Among Latinos, death is treated as the ally, and nothing can be greater than this conscious birth at the end of life. It is said we should approach our births while we slumber, but that we should approach our deaths, awakening, in that night between 2 days that we call death.
God, you made me. From before I was born, you took me through my life. You supported me. You were there with me when I wasn't there with you. There were times I was sick and you healed me. There were times I was in despair, and you gave me hope. There are times when I felt betrayed, and I could still turn to you. It was a wonderful life. I loved. Loved. I sang. I heard music. I saw flowers. I saw sunrises. Places when I was alone, you in my heart helped me turn loneliness into precious solitude. Panorama of my life, what a wonderful privilege this was. I still have some concerns for people in the family, for the world, for the planet. I put them in your blessed hands. Trust that whatever in the web of life that needed me to be there is now completed. I thank you for taking the burden from me. Thank you for keeping me in the light as I let go and let go.
When a person is first diagnosed as ill, the ego attempts to take control of the entire process. And once it is through its denial, it must go through its entire little cucaracha, its little dance, a wailing and a whining, but must also be overtaken by the larger work, the work of birthing to the next world. Kubler-Ross has documented the ego's grieving, its perceived end. Kubler-Ross identifies these as, among other things, denial, anger, grieving, bargaining, and resignation. It is when those issues of the ego, and all of them are ego issues, it is when issues of the ego pass that a person has a real opportunity, and rather than resignation, which is a sign, the last stage in accepting one's own dying, I would prefer the word proceeding. Because when we ally ourselves with death in those last days, we are proceeding, we are entering death con los ojos abiertos, entering death with our eyes wide open, and that is the way it is meant to be. So this desire to trick death, which has become so popular in the mainstream culture, has also become one of the top three political and moral issues of our time. But it should not be either. It is a soul issue, and a soul issue only, and should be treated as such. So it is up to the dying, and we who are close to the dying, by choosing clear power, to not allow anyone or any idea to split our thoughts about transformation and the healing and restoration of the soul to its rightful home. It is not beneficial at this critical time in a dying person's journey to turn them away from the light and back into the dark. The dying person's desire for restoration and healing must be considered in light of soul work and kept as an inner process, not an outer process, an inner one. Among the Hindus, I find a very useful metaphor. The ego is portrayed as a monkey, and as such it cannot help what it is. It likes every bright, shiny thing, but it is on a leash. It can only go so far. So when we die, we must tell it, "You cannot go with me, monkey. You must stay while I must go." And the monkey, of course, will cry tears, and you must have compassion for the monkey, but not too much compassion. For you have a night sea journey of the most important kind, and the monkey must stay on shore. And it is all right, it is as it was meant to be.
This life a ways back and put skin on to walk two-legged in this creation. And what a glorious time it was. It taught me about breath and about sensing and feeling and caring through my heart. And I walked on around that red road, looking and trying to understand more about the mystery and the secrets she holds. And you spoke to me through the wind. And you sang to me through the birds. You brought challenges forth so that I might listen to the message you bring me more sincerely. And I kept walking down this road. And I came round the bend at the middle of that curve in the road, and I began to find a secret in the spirit of myself.
Yeah, no, hey, no.
And still I walked on. Sometimes blind and deaf, and sometimes with pain. But I fought with my fears, and I embraced my unknowingness, and still I walked on. And my children and my family stood with me. And we came to know each other in those later years more than we had before. For some of our falseness had fallen away. And still I walked on. And I kept walking on this road towards you, towards that other world that grew closer to me with each step. The door of the great spirit world came closer. My fear loomed up inside sometimes, but something called me forth. The morning star rose with each day. And my prayer became a centering, and still I walked on. Until I began to hear the song of the mother. And her arms embraced me so. The door. And as the door opened, I heard her song. And her song lifted me up. So I could soar.
Good and healthy for people to have an imagination about what will happen when they die as something that they explore themselves, not something given to them by other people, but something that came to them in their own dream life, a symbol that is personal to them, and then to develop that from there, to believe in your own images, to give credence and weight to the things that you see in your mind's eye and that you hear with your inner hearing and that you sense with your inner sensitivities.
So, how does one enter death with one's eyes wide open? How does one make a conscious death? There are four tasks to that conscious crossing between the worlds. One is clear memory about where you came from, what you really are, your soul self. The second task is clear power. There is a saying, cultura curo, meaning that culture cures. The rituals, the rites, the beliefs of the culture cure the malaise of the heart and the soul. But in this culture we live in, it is a sick culture. And we must have clear power to die in our own way. The third task is clear seeing about the illusions of life and worldly attachments to people and things. We must have clear seeing about illusion in order to let go of this world eventually. The fourth task is clear knowing, meaning developing the intuition about the leave-taking of this world and especially the timing of one's own death. Let us begin with the first task, clear memory, about where you truly came from, who you truly are. There's a story about that. It is called The Seal Maiden. A story told across the world, for it is an archetype, in other words, a universal knowing or knowledge about an issue of the soul. It is a story told particularly in the cold countries, to the north. Listen. Here it is. Day after day of white sky and white snow, and only very occasionally something, a speck, a grain of black, a tiny something upon the horizon. It is like being in the center of a white world. They say here that humans do not move, animals do not move, only the white sky and the white land revolve. In this place where nothing thrives, except the hunter and the hunted, a place so windy it is said that people have come to wear their parkas, their mukluks, sideways on purpose now. A place so cold that one's words freeze in the open air and whole sentences must be broken off speakers' lips and carried inside and thawed at the fire so people can see what was said. In this land, the people claim to live in the white and abundant hair of old Anak'a, the old grandmother who is the earth herself. And it was that in this land there was a man. A man so lonely that tears had made a permanent furrow in his cheeks. But he tried to smile and be happy. He hunted, he trapped, he slept well, but he wished for human company. And sometimes out in the shallows in his kayak, when a seal came near, he'd remember the old stories about how seals were once human, and that the only reminder of that time when seals could talk was their eyes. Their eyes remained human and were capable of portraying human looks. Cherishing, fearing, loving. And sometimes in his skin boat he would veer close to a shiny seal and feel a lonely pang so great the tears would course down their well-known cracks in his face. And one night he was late back to land, having spent all day hunting and finding nothing. And as the moon began in the sky, and it was that deep light upon the blue and white ice that made it glisten as though a million crystals had shattered there, He came to a great spotted rock in the sea, and upon that old rock it appeared to his keen eye that there was movement of some kind. And he oared strong to be closer, and there atop the mighty rock danced a small group of women, naked as the day humans were born. Well, he was a lonely man, with no human friends but in memory, so he could not help but watch and stay longer and longer. He did, and the women were like beings made of creamy yellow moonlight, and their skin shimmered with little silver dots like those on the belly of the salmon in the springtime. And the women's feet and hands were long and graceful, and so beautiful were they that the man sat stunned in his boat, the water lapping, taking him closer and closer to the rock. He came so close he could hear the magnificent women laughing. At least they seemed to laugh, or was it the water lapping at the rock that was laughing? The man was confused and hard-pressed, for he was so dazzled, and somehow his loneliness, which had weighed on his chest like a wet bearskin, was lifted away for the first time, and almost without thinking, as though he was meant. He jumped up to the rock and stole one of the sealskins laying there, and he hid behind an outcropping, and he pushed the sealskin into his parka. Soon, one of the maidens called in a voice that was the most beautiful he'd ever heard, like the whales would call at dawn, or no, maybe it was more like the newborn wolves coming in the spring, or but, well, no, it was something better than that, but it did not matter, because what were they doing now? Why, the women were putting on their seal skins, and one by one the seal maidens were slipping into the sea, yelping and crying happily, except for one. The tallest of them searched high and searched low for her sealskin, and it could not be found. The man felt emboldened by what he did not know. He stepped from the rock, appearing and appealing to the maiden. Maiden, be my wife. I am a lonely man. Oh, I cannot be wife, she said, for I am of the other, the ones who live beneath. Be my wife, said the man. In 7 summers' time, I will return your sealskin to you, and you may stay or you may go as you wish. And the young seal maiden looked long into his face with eyes but for her true origins seemed human. Yes, she said reluctantly, I will go with you. After 7 summers, it shall be decided. So in time they had a child, a boy who they named Uruk, and the child was lithe and fat, and the mother would often in winter tell him the tales of the creatures that lived beneath the sea, while the father would whittle a white bear in white stone with his long knife. His mother would carry the child Uruk to bed, pointing out from the smoke hole the clouds in all their shapes. Except instead of recounting the shapes of raven and bear and wolf, she recounted the stories of walrus, whale, seal, and salmon. And so it went, until one night when the child was almost 7 years old, the young Uruk sat up in bed. He heard a roar that was his father fighting with his mother. He heard a crying like a stone rung on silver that was his mother. You hid my sealskin 7 long years ago, and now it is into the 8th winter. I want what I am made of returned to me now. And you, woman, would leave me if I gave it to you. I do not know what I would do. I only know I must have what I belong to. And you would leave me wifeless, and the boy motherless. You are bad. And with that, her husband tore the hide flap of the door aside and disappeared into the night. The boy loved his mother much and feared that she would leave him, and so cried himself to sleep, only to be awakened by the wind, a strange wind. It seemed to call to him. Bed. He climbed so hastily he put his parka on upside down and his mukluks half backward and dashed out into the starry, starry night. And the boy ran out to the cliff over the water, and there, far out in the windy sea, was a huge, shaggy silver seal. Its head was enormous. Its whiskers drooped to its chest. Its eyes were deep yellow. The boy scrambled down the cliff and stumbled at the bottom over a rock. No, a bundle that had rolled out of a cleft in the rock. The boy's hair lashed at his face like a thousand tongues made of ice. He scratched open the bundle and shook it out. It was his mother's sealskin, and he could smell her all through it. And as he hugged the sealskin to his face and inhaled her scent, her spirit slammed through him like a sudden summer wind. Oh, he cried with pain and joy and lifted the skin again to his face. And again her soul passed through his. And oh, he cried again, for he was being given the unending love of his mother. And the old silver seal, way out, sank slowly beneath the water. The boy climbed the cliff and began running toward home, with the sealskin flying behind him like a standard, like a flag. And into the house he fell before his mother, who swept him in the skin up and closed her eyes in gratitude for the safety of both. She pulled on her sealskin. Oh, mother, no, said the boy. She grabbed the child and put him under her arm and ran down to the sea. Oh, mother, don't leave me, Uruk cried. And at once you could tell she wanted to stay with her child. She wanted to, but something called her, something older than she, older than he, older than time. Oh, mother, no, 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 cried the child. She turned to him with a look of dreadful love in her eyes, and took the boy's face in her hand and breathed her sweet breath into his lungs once, twice, three times, and with him under her arm like a precious bundle, she dove into the sea, down and down and down and still deeper down. And the boy could breathe underwater, and they swam deep and strong, and they entered the cove of the seals, where all manner of creatures were dining and singing and dancing and speaking. And the great silver seal that had called to Uruk from the night sea embraced the child, called him grandson. And the great silver seal took aside his daughter and said, well, how fares it up there, daughter? A seal maiden looked away and said, I had to hurt a human. A man who gave his all to have me. But I cannot return, for I shall be a prisoner if I do. And the boy asked the old seal, my grandson. He said it so proudly his voice shook. He must go back, Father. He cannot stay. His time is not yet to be here with us. And she wept, and together they wept. And so some days and nights passed, 7 to be exact. And when it was time, the old grandfather seal and the boy's beautiful mother swam with the boy between them, back up and up and up to the topside world, and gently placed Uruk on the stony shore in the white world. His mother assured him, I will be with you in everything I have touched while I was here. Only touch what I have touched, my fire sticks, my ulu knife, my stone carvings of otters and seal, and I will be there with you like a wind blowing through you. And while looking back many times, the old silver seal and his daughter swam out to sea and disappeared beneath. And Uruk, because it was not his time, stayed. And people often remarked about his eyes, how they were deep and sorrowful, like those of the seal, and they guessed that was why he had become a mighty drummer and maker of stories. For it was said he had visited the underworld as a child, and that he had had a mother who loved him. So, there is the first task, clear memory of who you are. Are you a human? Yes, but only temporarily. Are you a child? Yes, but also temporarily. While here on Earth, an important aspect of the soul is always hidden away. As in this story, what is hidden away is the duality, the ability to live in both worlds. Without the seal skin, soul skin, we can only live in one world. With the seal skin, with the soul skin, totally intact, we begin to yearn for our home world, the world we came from, the world before this one. In the story, the boy's mother touches his soul, imprints her love for him through the scent and feel of her soul skin. Even when people die, if they have been real, if they have been soulful with those they love, there is no real leave-taking. For the force of that soul is with those it loves, always and forever. In metaphysics, there's an idea of soul typing, where there are groups of people, souls, if you will, who are all related to each other, who are never separate from each other, who move through time as a great group of people who are like all ribbons entwined with one another. And even though some may be further away or drift off, they're never really separate from each other. They're connected, as though with a common umbilicus. I have been asked, do the dead speak to the living? I'll say, oh, most definitely, and vice versa. I've always been quite taken by those here who insist on speaking with the dead. And I do not mean mediums, I mean just usual folks. It is a veritable habit, this speaking to the dead, among very, very young people and very, very old people. In fact, it seems by the time midlife appears, almost everyone has forgotten almost everything important, and then we all have to go about remembering it again. But among the very young and the very old, they seem to know how to talk to the spirits of those who have passed. I was just thinking of an old grandma who lives in the woods on the shore of Lake Michigan where I grew up, and she's now at least 1,100 years old, and she's part of a group of old cackling women who live up there on the on the lakeshore in the old summer cottages that they've winterized. And she's part Cherokee, as many of the old women of those parts are. And she talks to her dead husband, Henry, all the time. People ask her why she does that, and she fixes them with that old reptile eye. And she says, and why shouldn't I? She crabs at everyone who asks her. I talked to him when he was alive. It would be rude to ignore him just because he's dead. She remembers who the soul with the name and body of Henry really is, and I'm convinced she and the other old ones like her remember who they themselves are too and where they come from. She is very fond of saying, some of us are lifers and some of us are part-timers. She claims to have been a part-timer all her life, part here and part there in the other world. And she's very fond of saying, death ain't gonna be no surprise to me. And then she laughs, and her canaries bounce around in their cages laughing too. And this is another aspect of what the first task of clear memory is all about.
No one has ever prepared us for this experience. We think it's the end. No. It's another beginning. Another beginning. It's knowing that you loved. Knowing that you loved. It's not easy letting yourself be loved. We've learned to judge ourselves. We're always judging ourselves. But I learned to listen that I was loved. I was loved. And then I would forget that I was loved. Those were the most painful times for me, forgetting that I was loved. So you've let yourself be loved while you've been here, and you've judged yourself. And you've forgotten that you were loved. And you became alone. But you will always be here. You are blessed. You are forgiven. You are an angel. Listen that you loved. And you have to forgive all the time. Listen that you loved.